In today's episode,
what are the principles, the skills, the building blocks that are going to be the same 5 years from now, 10 years from now, maybe even 20 years from now. And so I really started studying history. You know, I started studying the early days of technology and then going back studying the Industrial Revolution and then going back studying the Enlightenment and then the Renaissance, going all the way back to like ancient Greek times. And I found these kind of four timeless steps that you can see at work in all kinds of creativity across essentially all time, which are the letters of code: capture, organize, distill, and express.
This week's episode is sponsored by AppSumo, the marketplace entrepreneurs trust to buy and sell products that grow small businesses into name brands. There's no better place for tools to help you build and grow your business. Whether you're a content creator, designer, or marketer, they're connected to some of the hottest tech companies, so you don't have to waste time searching for great stuff. AppSumo makes it easy for you to automate and boost your productivity so you can actually focus on your business. Sign up at AppSumo.com or hit the link in the description below. Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi, and I have a very special guest here today, Tiago Forte, founder of Building a Second Brain. You've seen him on Twitter. You've seen him on all over the internet, and I've got him here today for you. So, Tiago, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, man. Really good to be here.
Yeah, we've been speaking, I think, like in over Twitter and DMs and stuff for a little bit of time, but haven't had a chance to actually lock this down, so I'm glad we finally got to do this. I think a lot of people listening to this have probably already heard of you because it's definitely in the same kind of wheelhouse and area that we're both interested in. But for people who don't know who you are and the work you're doing, could you just give a kind of summary on what you're working on and your background?
Sure. Definitely the central focus these days is building a second brain, which is an idea. It is a movement. It is an online course that I've taught for the past 5 or 6 years. And now a book, which is published in the US and the UK and soon in a few other countries. So building a second brain is basically, you can think of it as the practice of creating a system. And the system is a system for knowledge management. It's a place, in my case, a software program that is outside of your head, right? So it's not something you have to memorize or remember. It exists outside your head. It's a place where you put, where you store all of your ideas, insights, memories, theories you have about the world, knowledge and expertise from your job, information you need to do your job or to run your business, information to manage your household, to manage your family, like all the responsibilities of life, I believe shouldn't all fall on your first brain, on your biological mind, which has so many talents, but memorizing and remembering things is not one of them. My message is to outsource, to offload those details, those memories and ideas into what I call your second brain.
Love it, man. So we're going to go into very tactical and actionable like frameworks to actually apply this to your own life and the tools you use and that sort of stuff. But kind of philosophically, I'm curious, like what led you to that in the first place? Because it's quite it's one of those topics which is applicable to pretty much everyone. Like everyone wants to organize information better, you know, keep their life organized, move things forward in the right direction, which this can all help. But in a way, it's also quite a narrow, focus as well. So I'm curious, like, what was your background getting into this in the first place?
Yeah, you know, it really started for me, this practice of taking digital notes, which is another way you can think of it, with a really terrible medical condition that I had around now 14 years ago or so, 14 or 15 years. I was 21 or 22. I was working at the Apple store in San Diego. I was in college. And out of the blue, for no apparent reason, I started having this terrible pain and tension in my throat, in my neck. And to this day, I actually don't even know the cause. But the U.S. medical system is such that when you have especially a chronic condition, you have all this information to manage. You know, you're seeing multiple doctors. None of them are communicating with each other. So you have to take notes on what the doctors are telling you. You have to navigate, you know, if they're giving you conflicting advice. You have to keep track of your medications, your tests, your diagnostics. And then on top of all that is the insurance, all the insurance paperwork and all the things you have to file and claim and pay for. And, you know, I was 21 or 22. I didn't have the work. I was just trying to like make it through college. And suddenly I had this whole like part-time job keeping track of all this stuff. And so I had to start just getting all that paperwork, scanning it into my computer and managing it digitally. And I just had to come up with some simple, practical ways of not just storing digital content, but using it, right? Actually putting it into practice. And that was the beginning of everything for me.
Love it, man. So, I mean, obviously terrible that you had a medical issue, but I'm saying the fact that it led you to something that's just, you know, essentially changed your life and many other people's, I'm sure. So let's go into the kind of step after that, though, because, you know, after you've had the necessity part, like the way I've seen your frameworks used, which we're going to go into today, a lot of the time for like people doing the complete opposite, which is a very expressive, you know, knowledge management, like I've learned this thing, but how do I remember it properly? And how do I, you know, express it in a way that I'm going to remember it 10 years from now, or and reformat it in a different format for myself or others? So like, when did it go from that kind of like necessity to kind of like what it is today?
Very slowly. I mean, this has kind of been my intention with, you know, teaching this and writing the book. Was it took me 15 years. It took me 15 years of trial and error, making every mistake, going down so many dead ends, trying so many overly complicated approaches or, you know, software programs. And ultimately, I kind of went through this arc. I mean, the answer to your question is, you know, once I started using it to manage my medical condition, I started to just expand the use cases. I used it to teach English in South America while I was studying abroad. I used it to apply to the Peace Corps, which is a US volunteer program, served in Ukraine for 2 years. Used it to teach English while I was in Ukraine. Came back to the US, used it to apply for my first job, got that job. Then I used it to, you know, to handle and to do that job. Then when I left the consulting firm where I worked, I used it to start a blog and then to start a business and then to write a book. So I've just slowly been applying the same kind of general approach to organizing information to more and more parts of my life. But it's funny where I've ended up with after all that time. You'd think I would have created this ultimate sophisticated system. Usually when I share my screen or when people just look over my shoulder, they're surprised how simple, casual, informal, and even kind of spontaneous my note-taking methods are, right? Like I went through the arc of trying all the most fancy systems out there, and I've kind of like come back to the opinion that it's really these simple everyday habits that in many cases people are already doing, they just don't realize they're doing them, that are the most effective and the most sustainable.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it takes sometimes to go through the complicated stuff to get to the simple part. Like you need to understand all the options out there sometimes for a certain type of person. For someone else is, oh, this works, is good enough, let me just get on with my day, which honestly might be the best approach for most people. But I'd say like probably I'd put myself in a similar bucket to someone like yourself, like likes to get into the details and understand things at a high level and then can figure out what works for me. But I think for something like this, like you said, an organizational system, a way to write and organize your own information, that like you said, there's unlimited iterations of this. And sometimes I've found, especially in the last few years, when there's new software, like I still use Evernote, which I know you do as well, you just shared your screen a second ago and we will do that later in the show. You know, people have got Notion and Airtable and Roam Research and all these different tools, which in a way are amazing, right? Like if that helps people write things better and organize their life, then great. But in many ways, like the best people I've interviewed that are the most creative people. So I'm thinking of, there's a guy called Tim Urban who's got he's a writer from Wait But Why. He literally has about 7 equivalent of post-it notes just going on at once on his screen. And like Notepad, you know, like old school style. Polina from The Profile, she does the same. She basically thinks that all those tools are just overblown most of the time. So again, everyone is different, but it is interesting to see that you've kind of gone back to the original approach as well, because I think it comes down to keeping things as simple as possible and actually sticking to something. So we'll go into some of those details a little bit later anyway. One thing I did want to call out first is just my own personal experience with this kind of world, because I think people who listen to the show probably know this already, but there's a kind of group of like productivity, you know, YouTubers and, you know, content creators, which I'd say you might be within that group as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've learned quite a lot of things from those people, like Ali Abdal and Thomas Frank, like these sort of people who, if you type in productivity on YouTube, they're kind of like ranking right at the top. At the same time, I have this weird relationship with it, because I think sometimes a lot of people can just be on this hamster wheel of productivity and they're like overly obsessed about it, and that I need to do every single shortcut and I need to figure out the perfect system. And my kind of message always, especially with Creator Lab, is just like the 80-20 of this should be very simple, and the principles and why you're doing things is normally what gets you to do the best work. And of course, these tools can definitely help you. And I think your approach is more of a framework versus just, hey, use these shortcuts to be much quicker at your job. So I just wanted to say that up front.
It's funny you say that. We recently, actually, as part of the process of, you know, marketing and promoting this book, we did kind of like a research study of our followers. The first time we ever did anything like this, hired an outside firm. They polled like hundreds and hundreds of our followers. And the most common thing they found was that it wasn't a demographic, right? It wasn't like a certain age or a certain like profession or a certain region that was the most common factor. It was, the most common factor was that they had tried something basic. They had read a productivity book, followed a productivity blog or YouTube channel, become disillusioned with it, and were now looking for something deeper or something more effective or something more nuanced. That single thing was the most common sort of impulse that led them to me and led them to us, which is true. Like building a second brain is not the simplest approach to productivity, right? Some people just need to hear, okay, have a post-it on your desk, write down the three things you're going to do today and do them, right? There's a lot of people that just need to follow that advice. But I kind of think of building a second brain as the next level after that. If you are
the power user version,
the power user or the prosumer or the person who's like not just completing tasks, but you're trying to produce something, a piece of writing, a presentation, some kind of output, some kind of complex result, you need content management. You have to keep track of ideas. And that when you're ready for that, come to us, because that is when you're going to need a second brain.
Got it. Yeah, and we're going to talk about your book, obviously, throughout the conversation, but you also have a cohort-based course. I know you work with David Perel too, right? You two do something together.
Yeah.
You've actually got some really, there's some old videos of you two from several years ago that I've watched like years ago on kind of a lot of your process, and like you share your screen and stuff, which I found actually very helpful. So yeah, people should check that out as well. And just because this is obviously a business podcast and I want to show you off a little bit to people, you have a multi-million dollar course business, it sounds like, right? So could you tell us a little bit about kind of just the high level, most impressive numbers you could share on the business side itself?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. The course is a 4-week online course, but it's really different from what most people think of when they hear the word course. We're used to self-paced courses, right? Where you go online, there's a bunch of videos and you just sit there at your computer watching videos and that's the course. That is not at all what we do. We're part of it's actually kind of a trend called CBCs, which stands for cohort-based courses, which are live courses. So we have usually between 500 and 1,000 students in each cohort. A cohort is just a group of people that join at the same time and then go through the curriculum at the same pace. So between 500 and 1,000 people from usually more than 50 separate countries. And instead of being, you know, anonymous icons on a website, we get on Zoom calls. We have 1,000 to 2,000 plus person Zoom calls. And I teach live. I teach them live, and then I don't just teach, I don't just lecture, but because it's Zoom and we have this interactivity and we're there at the same time, we can interact. People can ask questions. We can have discussions. We do breakout rooms. I do demonstrations of my own system. People ask questions about that demonstration. It's like much more like, you know, college or high school, where we're used to talking, than what most people think of. And so some numbers, let's see, I've been doing it since late 2016, early 2017, so like 5 to 6 years. We've had over now 5,000 graduates from over 100 countries take the program. It's generated probably more than $5 million. I don't know the total actually, but upwards of $5 million in that time. The biggest cohort we've had was about 1,500 people. And I don't know, what else do you want to know about it?
No, that's awesome. No, that's already, that's very impressive and builds a good picture there. And if anyone's listening to this, interested in that world, I did an episode with Gagan Biyani, who is the founder of Maven. And he also was a founder of Udemy. So we talk all about cohort-based courses and kind of why they're more effective in many ways than, you know, self-paced courses and stuff like that. But yeah, very impressive. And for a creator out there who's writing and sharing knowledge, this is obviously one way where people can, you know, really monetize at a level like you have, and, you know, obviously help people with a more high touch approach. So very, very cool. So people can go check that out as well. We're going to get into the frameworks in a second from the book. But before we do that, I did also, I saw you it was either on your website or one of your profiles, you'd written, part of your work is creating systems for behavior change and using technology for self-tracking. And I just wanted to hone in on the idea of behavior change first, because ultimately all of this is dependent on behavior change, right? Like, you already do your work in one way, or your the way you eat today in one way, or your exercise routine, whatever it is. Everyone listening to this has some sort of behavior change they're working on. And I'm just curious to hone in on that. Like, again, if you were thinking of like the 80-20 of positive behavior change, sustained behavior change, what keeps people doing things 30 days from now, 6 months from now, 12 months from now? I assume you've thought a lot about this. So I'm curious, like, from your experience, what makes people have that sustained behavior change?
Yeah, that's a really great observation. I think people often miss this, or it kind of gets hidden, is at least the way that I approach it, the way that I teach it, the way that I think of it is, you know, I really, there's all these promises out there, just buy this thing, just acquire this product, just download this app. You don't have to change. You don't have to do anything different. Just buy this in your life, the magic pill or the silver bullet or the Hail Mary, which I get it is so attractive. Right? Like, who wants to change? We just want to, you know, acquire something and have it transform our lives. But it's just so rare, if ever, that is true, especially in the world of productivity. If there was any silver bullet, you know, it would be a $1 trillion business. And so I think you really just can't fall for those kind of simplistic promises. And this is why I teach this as a course, by the way. People enter the course, they think there's like a formula or a template. There's not. There truly is not. You have to go through this personal process of behavior change, which is different for every single person, right? What works for you may not at all work for me, and vice versa. It depends on your lifestyle, your temperament, your personality, your use cases, your profession, your background, your skill, like all these things that are so different from person to person. So really, you can think of building a second brain as a knowledge management method, but it's also a behavior change method, because all the benefits come when you change the way you are being, the way you are acting towards information in your life. And software is just a facilitator of that.
Got you, man. Yeah, completely. And I was thinking of just from my own personal experience, like outside of work, let's just say eating better food, right? Like, because all of us are generally trying to eat healthier and be healthier in general, right? So in the past, I've done this thing where I've gone very, very extreme, and I'm a pretty extreme person. So I'm either going, you know, ham on one side, or I'm going, oh, I'm extra clean, I'm drinking green juice every day and, you know, feeling amazing. But I find it very hard to balance that. And it's like even something I'm kind of going through right now, where I'm trying to find that sustained behavior change. And so I was just going to share a couple, and it might spur ideas from you as well, from all the people you've taught. One of it is just accountability. Like, it sounds obvious, but just, you know, in a cohort-based course, obviously you have other people around that, a group of people you end up speaking to after and staying in touch with. And you have the accountability of turning up every day at a certain time versus, mm-hmm. I can click a button and watch that in bed on my phone whenever I want on demand. And then the other kind of part is obviously, like, you know, measuring, like being able to see tangibly, these are things that made me feel better. This made me lose weight, build muscle, etc. And again, that's not rocket science. People know that already. But the lowest kind of touch version of that. So, yeah, that was kind of some of the things I was thinking of outside of work. And I'm trying to think, you know, even just like I use Superhuman, right? Like the email software. I had Rahul on the show as well. For many years, I didn't use it because I just thought, oh, well, my email works already and I don't need to pay $30 a month for this. And then got to a certain point where I looked at my email and I said, okay, this is getting a little bit out of hand and I haven't solved this for a long time. And that was the behavior change came from me jumping on a call with someone on their team for 45 minutes, learning new things and then practicing it every day for a few months, essentially. So I'm curious, like, just with that lens, are there other things you've seen that might be worth adding? And if not, we can move on, but just curious if anything comes to mind.
Yeah, you know, it's behavior change is a very nuanced subject. You know, there's these books that come out on the subject of behavior change that always have like the answer. But I find, and this has really come from directly coaching and interacting with people in the course, which constantly surprises me, that very different things work for different people. You know, just as a few examples, some people really do well with internal sources of accountability.
Oh, yeah.
Other people need external, right? Some people really do well with punishment, where there's like a negative consequence to a behavior. Other people, that really makes them go off the wagon. They need positive,
that's a great point,
you know, rewards. Some people, you know, benefit when it's social and when it includes others. Other people really don't. So it's like, there's really not a one size fits all solution. Like you mentioned a couple examples that works for you. That shows that you have self-awareness, that you've tried things, that you've had the sort of presence to see what's working and to be curious about yourself. Like that's really, I think what's needed is you have to almost treat yourself as like a experimental subject, you know, like, wow, look at this being that I was born into, look at this body that I inhabit, right? Yeah. Like it seems to have certain tendencies and certain habits that it is pushed or pulled toward. And you want to approach it from a place of, you know, open-mindedness and gratitude and acceptance and also curiosity. Like, what are the things that make me tick? What are the things that might be small, but change how I think or how I feel or how my body operates or my mind operates? And sometimes it's something that seems so small and insignificant to other people, but for you, it makes this huge impact.
100%. Have you got kids by any chance?
Yes, we have one son. His name is Caillou.
Oh, amazing. Beautiful name. Yeah. I'm curious, like, and how old is he, if you don't mind me asking?
He's 20 months.
20 months. Okay. So I'm not sure if he's at the stage yet where you're starting to notice some of these things, but for a lot of my friends, I don't have kids yet, but a lot of like my nephew and my, all my friends have kids. So just seeing that, like you can see the DNA in them. Like you said, like one of them is just running and will just be completely fine and falling over and getting up. And the other one is completely cautious, and they're completely different to their parents too. And if you see that kid grow up into an 18-year-old and a 52-year-old, which is all of us essentially, you realize like how individual we are, and a lot of that comes from one, the DNA, but also the experiences we have, especially as kids. Not to turn this into a therapy session, but you know, that's definitely a part of it. So yeah, great macro point there. I think there isn't a one size fits all approach, but those are some of the things that have helped me anyway. I'm sure people have got their own versions of that. So let's go into the framework and the ideas a little bit deeper. And we're going to try to share examples where we can. And you said you might even share a screen if it makes sense. So kind of at a high level, let's talk about, you know, you've got a whole book on this, so we're not going to be able to cover every single part. But from your book, you have this four steps of your method, which the acronym is CODE. capture, organize, distill, express. Could you go into a little bit more detail on what that means and what part of the stage, what part of the process is this, and what do each of those mean?
Yeah, so code is the core methodology of the book and of my work in general. It is the hard won, you know, results. It's so simple. You think, oh, you know, it's so straightforward, but the amount of time it took me to arrive at that is kind of amazing. And to kind of give you the background, I was looking, the reason I was looking for something like that is I was in the world of technology. I was working for a consulting firm in Silicon Valley, working with a lot of tech companies. And looking around me, working for all these different companies, everything was constantly changing. Every 6 months, every year, there's like a whole new trend. There's a whole new wave. The thing that was new last year is now obsolete. It's like this constant like ocean tide of just churning and change, which is exciting and fun, but it's also disconcerting because more and more industries and companies are starting to face that, right? Like even older traditional industries are starting to encounter technology-driven change. And it's quite a challenge. And so looking at the level of the individual, just for myself, I was like, okay, well, what is timeless here? Like amidst all this change and uncertainty, what is the thing that doesn't change? What are the principles, the skills, the you know, the building blocks that are going to be the same 5 years from now, 10 years from now, maybe even 20 years from now? And so I really started studying history. You know, I started studying the early days of technology and then going back, studying the Industrial Revolution and then going back, studying the Enlightenment and then the Renaissance, going all the way back to like ancient Greek times. And I found these kind of four timeless steps that you can see at work in all kinds of creativity across essentially all time, which are the letters of code: capture, organize, distill, and express. So we can go through those if you want, but basically that's what it is. It's the timeless creative process.
Yeah. And just for people who might have read your blog post, because you've got a summary blog post, which is titled Building a Second Brain, an Overview, last modified in 2020. I'm sure a lot of the principles are the same. There are like kind of like you've used code in there too, but on the blog you have part one, remember, part two, connect, part three, create. Would you say that basically ties in with what you just described there on the code side, or am I kind of like mixing them up?
Yeah, so there's two things. Code is what is the individual creative process. It's what each person is stepping through, capturing information, organizing information, distilling information, expressing information. But then there's another kind of framework, which you're referring to in that blog post, which is the stages that someone moves through as they improve and increase their skills.
Got it.
Right?
Got it.
So there's kind of like phases, right? In the first phase, which is when people just get started, they're just remembering. They're just literally writing something. Like they're in a meeting, they write down something their boss said. A few days later, they go into that note and they just look at what they said. I mean, it's just memory, right? It's just remembering what happened in the past. Very, very simple. and that's I think, an important first step because, you know, going back to behavior change, most people are just, as a default state, totally overwhelmed. Like the average person, professional, is underwater, right? Their bandwidth is not 0%. It's like negative. They're at like 110% capacity. So you can't really change anything. You can't even really learn anything. You can't take on anything new until you make some space, right? You have to free up some bandwidth just to be able to think, just to be able to move. And so that's why that first phase is so important. You got to get stuff off your mind before you can learn anything else, right? But then people tend to start there, but then they kind of evolve and mature over time. So the second phase is connecting, right? Once you've stored all these things in your second brain, you start to notice, oh, there's a connection, there's an association, there's a relationship. And they start having new ideas, new combinations of thoughts that are kind of more novel and interesting. And then there's a third phase, which they start to kind of move to naturally, which is once they've noticed enough of these connections, they start to realize, oh, I have something that I want to create, right? Going back to the theme of your podcast, I have something that I want to build, something that I want to express, a talk I want to give, a piece of writing I want to publish, a product I want to make. And that is sort of the third and most, I guess, developed version of a second brain.
This episode is sponsored by The Economist. If you're listening to this right now, I know you like to stay on top of things. The world is moving at a faster pace than ever. Climate and economics, politics and culture, science and technology, wherever you look, events are unfolding at pace. And for now, for the first time, you can get a 30-day trial of The Economist so you won't miss a thing. I've read The Economist since I studied economics at school and university. It's always been my go-to resource for deeply researched expert analysis, and it allows me to hone in on what matters most to me. With this trial, you'll get access to in-depth, independent coverage of world events through their podcasts and webinars, expert analysis, and even their extensive archives. So whether you want to catch up on current events or dive deeper into specific issues, The Economist delivers global perspectives with distinctive clarity. For example, I just read through their recent write-up on AI's new frontier. It was an absolute eye-opener. Get full access and a 30-day trial by going to economist.com/lab. That's economist.com/lab to start your 30-day trial with The Economist today, because the world won't wait. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. With spring in the air, it's time for renewal and growth, personally and professionally. As your small business grows, LinkedIn Jobs is here to make it easier to find people you want to talk to faster and for free. Here's how to get started. In a few minutes, create a free job post on LinkedIn Jobs and you'll tap into the world's largest professional network. Then add your job and the purple hashtag hiring frame to your profile to spread the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people. Use simple tools like screening questions to make it easy to focus on candidates with the right skills so you can prioritize who you'd like to interview and hire. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs the number one place in delivering high quality hires versus their competitors. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates you want to talk to faster, and you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/creator. Again, that's linkedin.com/creator to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Now let's get straight back to the show. Got it. Yeah, no, I love that. It's like beginner, you know, intermediate, advanced kind of stages, and most people kind of only get to the first stage. Like most people write notes in some form, but they're not actually taking it to the next level. So let's go into some of those. We can't summarize the whole blog post. I'll definitely recommend people go check that out as well, and obviously the book. But one of the phrases you use in that is think like a curator. So this is for part one in the remember stage. I really love that phrase, think like a curator. What does that mean? And why should people think like a curator versus the alternative?
Yeah, you know, I call it the curator's mindset. And I think it's so important because, you know, the information stream that we are now immersed in is so vast. It's so unhumanly immense that if you try to just drink from that stream, you know, it's like going down to a raging river and just like putting your mouth down and trying to like drink, you know, 1,000 gallons per second of volume. It's just, first of all, impossible, but also stressful, incredibly anxiety provoking, incredibly FOMO inducing, right? You can't drink directly from the information stream anymore. You have to step back and create kind of a buffer, some kind of filter that allows you to take things in for your consideration, allows you to look at them, think about them, reflect on them. And then only then, if it's relevant, if it's useful, if it's healthy, if it's good for you, take that into your actual mind. And that filter is your second brain, right? So practical example, let's say you encounter an article, right, on the internet. You don't have time probably to stop what you're doing. You shouldn't take the time to stop what you're doing and spend 20, 30 minutes reading this super in-depth article, right? It just doesn't make sense. And yet also, you don't just want to leave that browser tab open, because before long, you have 30 browser tabs. You know you're not going to get to them, but you also feel guilty. You feel FOMO that you're not getting to those. There's another option, which is save that resource, that article, to your second brain and get to it later. It's there for safekeeping, so you don't have to either instantly react to it or forget it forever.
And so in practical terms, what do you actually do? So let's say you see an article like we all do every day on Twitter, or someone's written a thread or something like that. But you're, like you said, you're busy, you're in the middle of something. What is your practical step in that first moment to capture that? I know that you've, you know, even on the to-do list side, you use like an inbox too, right? Which is kind of like the getting things done approach. Like if anyone's ever followed that or read that book, you need a place to just dump the information, right? So whether that's an article, or it's, oh, I've got to do that for my kid tomorrow and I'm running right now, I'm not going to have a chance to, I'm going to forget about it. I do that right now. I use a to-do list called Things, and I put it in the inbox, and then later in the day I'll go in and organize it. So could you give an example of like an article that you think, oh, that's something that I want to go deeper in? What would you do at that moment?
Yeah, so great question. I also use Things. I've used it for a decade.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the best pieces of software. I love it. It's so beautifully designed.
I love it. It's my favorite. Yeah. So I'd actually like to show you what this looks like. But the first thing to keep in mind is your second brain. When I say your second brain, I don't just mean a notes app. Right? A digital notes app like Evernote, Notion, Microsoft OneNote, Apple Notes is the centerpiece. It's like the main kind of repository of knowledge. But your second brain is actually the whole ecosystem of different apps and other tools that you use to manage information. That's a common misconception. People think it's an app. It's not an app. It's a system.
System together, yeah.
Which includes different parts. Just actually like your biological brain has different like lobes and different, you know, like different
interconnectedness.
Sections.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in this case, would that step be like using Pocket or Instapaper or something like that? Like a quick capture sort of thing? Is that what you'd recommend?
Exactly. So let's say I have that article. I haven't read it yet. I don't want to put it directly into my notes app. And the reason for that is you want everything in the notes app itself to be something you've already seen that you've already decided is worth keeping for the long term. So don't dump things into there. Don't just stick things in there willy-nilly. Instead, there's a step before that, which is a Read Later app. Read Later app is a category that has a bunch of different options now. There's the OG ones, which are Instapaper and Pocket. And then there's a new series of new apps like Matter, Readwise, and a few others that are kind of coming on the scene. But basically, so let me show you what this looks like for me. Say I come across this article, I'm kind of concerned about inflation, so I want to check it out, but not now, right? I don't want to interrupt my workday. All I'm going to do is right-click it, and then you see right here it says Save to Instapaper, right? If I click that, this little thing comes down from the top that says Saved, and then within a few seconds, I need to do a refresh. That article is right here inside Instapaper, right? So that might seem really small and insignificant, but it's actually huge because it means that all day long, I'm just saving stuff to Instapaper. Oh, something from Twitter, right click, save. Oh, something on Facebook, right click, save. Something from email, right click, save. Something on WhatsApp, right click, save. And then it all appears here in my, think of it like a curated feed. It's a curated feed of everything that I've said I want to read, or if it's a video, watch, or a podcast, listen to.
Got it. Yeah, no, beautiful. And then just since we've got the screen open, what are other sort of features that take this from reading to actually in Evernote or something? Because I know you can do highlights and stuff like that. I'm curious like what your system actually looks like from there.
Yeah, great. So let's say later that evening, a few days later on the weekend, basically when I have time, let's say I come back to this article, right, which I've already said that I want to read, and I find something like an interesting fact, right, like this one. For two straight months, the primary consumer expenses have all been rising at double-digit annual rates. That's a piece of research. That's a finding, right? So now think about if I decide this is useful to me, let's say I'm an economist, or I'm an investment advisor, or just for my household expenses, I want to keep track of this. This could be useful in the future, right? So all I have to do is highlight that sentence and hit the highlight button right here. See how it turns yellow?
Yeah.
Right? It's similar to like when you're reading an ebook. You can just go through and highlight all the parts that you want to keep.
Kindle, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think the equivalent of this in Kindle is there's something called Readwise, I think you mentioned. and that can surface a lot of your highlights, I believe.
Exactly. Yeah. So that, again, seems very simple. But now here's the magical part. If we go over to Evernote, notice just now, like within seconds of me doing that, the highlight, the full part that I highlight, is saved in my notes in a permanent format that, by the way, I can edit. I can add a bold. I can add a highlight, make it stand out even more. If I ever want to go back to the original source to be able to cite my sources, I can just click this link. The title is automatically here in the title of the note. So look what just happened. Beautiful. Through the simple act of making a highlight, I've created, I think of this as like a knowledge building block. This is a small atomic piece of knowledge that in the future could have all sorts of use cases.
That's great. So from now we've got, I mean, this is the best way to learn this. So just so people know tactically how to do this, you need one of those read later apps. Within that, they have an option to sync with Evernote, right? Does Pocket do the same, I think?
Yeah, so this is where we get into in the course kind of this like troubleshooting process, because it takes a few things, right? Like it's good to keep in mind, these companies don't really want you to do this. Right? Like the tech companies don't really want you to take control of your information. The, you know, the news websites, the different media websites don't really want you to save content. So like this process takes a little bit of effort, because it's not really in their interest to enable this. It's in your interest. Okay. So setting up what I just demonstrated takes a few things, and it depends on the Read Later app you're using. It depends on the Notes app that you're using. So in some cases, to answer your question, in some cases, it's a built-in feature. All you have to do is go into the Read Later app and connect it and sign in to say Evernote or Notion or whatever it is. In other situations, you have to use a third-party tool. And the one you use, again, depends. Like you can use Readwise. The three that you can consider are Readwise, a tool called IFTTT, ifttt.com, which stands for if this, yeah, if this, then that. And the third one is called Zapier. So one of those three, depending on your needs, is gonna work.
And just so I know, for your one, do you know what you're using for
the IFTTT. I'm using IFTTT. You could also use Readwise to do exactly what I demonstrated, though.
Awesome. All right, cool. So now you've got it in this inbox. I can see on the left-hand side. So for people listening, I would suggest click the link in the show notes below and go over to YouTube and see this screen share, because it's very helpful, because it's actually demonstrating in practice what these the parts of the framework actually apply to. So you've got a notebook called Inbox, and then one projects, and then a bunch of stuff after that. What happens from here? You might elaborate on this, you might write your own notes, stuff like that. How do you then organize this to go from Inbox to somewhere else?
Yes. So the inbox, as you said, is sort of the default place where things come in, right? Sometimes you're actually, as in this example, sometimes you're saving things to your notes app without even opening the notes app, right? Like you may be forwarding something from your email, you may be web clipping something from a website. So the app needs to know, okay, where do I put something when it's just coming in? And that's your inbox. But then you're right, it needs to go somewhere. Right. You don't want to just, you can let it accumulate here for a while, like a week or two or something, but eventually you want to do what I call triage, which is sorting these notes into the different folders where they'll be most useful. And to do that, I have an organizing method that's called PARA, P-A-R-A. I'm a big fan of four letter frameworks.
Yeah, they work, man.
Yes.
So those are projects, area, resources, archive, right?
Exactly. So I have the four categories exactly are those four, which are projects. I simply have a folder for each one of my currently active projects, right? And that's where I want to start, right? This little excerpt on inflation, I want to know, is there anything that I'm working on now at this moment that I could use this right away? So I can kind of just go through this list and kind of just ask myself, is there anything? And there really isn't. There's actually no current project that this is useful for, which is the moment that I turn to areas. Okay, so the second category is areas, which are the different responsibilities that I have in my life, the different hats that I wear. things like my son, our car, clothing, cooking, finances. I have different areas for my business, which is all the ones that start with FL for Forte Labs. Health, my wife, personal development, productivity, travel, our dog, right? These are things that are, they're not projects, right? They're not something that I'm trying to finish as soon as possible.
They're
ongoing, you know, aspects of my life.
So these will basically be there. They're like evergreen areas most of the time, I'm assuming.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yeah. So once again, I can just ask myself, is there any area of my life that this is relevant to? You know, I could put it in finances, but it doesn't seem particularly relevant there. No, there's actually not really any relevant area, which is fine.
Yeah, got you.
This is the opportunity to go to resources, which is the third category, right? So resources is like everything else. It's like my library. It's all the topics that I'm interested in, curious about, that I'm learning about, that I'm exploring, everything from books and writing to business cards, to generosity, to languages, to music, to philosophy, to stock photos, right? These are like basically my interests.
Got it. So just to clarify, the resources here though, these are resources. So versus areas were like your life areas, like you said, people, your travel, your dog, your kid, etc. These are just area resources that you're like interested in. So they could be they're kind of like topics, I guess, is a similar way of thinking of it. Is there a difference between resources and topics, or would you say topics is closer to area?
No, I think topics or interests is a good way of thinking of it.
Got it.
The reason that I like the word resources, by the way, you could also just use for the R in para, you could say research. Or you could say reference. Those work just as well, right?
That makes sense.
The reason that I like resources is it's kind of more utilitarian, right? It just like reminds me that I'm not just collecting knowledge to collect knowledge. Like I want these building blocks of information to be useful. I want them to be resources in something that I'm trying to produce or achieve or create. So that's why I prefer the term resources.
No, I like that. Yeah. And then the last one is archive. So those I'm assuming is once you need to file those away, they're not really active anymore. So are they normally more projects that are archived? I assume because resources feels a bit more evergreen as well. So I'm curious, like what are you using in the archives here?
Yeah, exactly. Archives is cold storage. Archives is like the filing cabinet in your garage or your basement of stuff that you want to keep or you need to keep, but that in the meantime, you don't want cluttering your space, right? It's like the cold, the freezer where things get archived away. Yeah. And you're right. It is largely projects because projects finish, right? Projects have an outcome. They have an end date, but it can be areas and resources too. And here's why. An area is evergreen, but they can sometimes end. Right? Like think about something like a relationship. A relationship is not a project. There's no like end, there's no deadline, right? But relationships can end.
Got you. Right? Yeah. That makes sense. So there are cases where it will be some of those other areas, but probably a lot of the volume is probably from the projects, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. And resources is the same. Sometimes you just lose interest. You have an interest in, you know, in the past I was interested in web design, but then I thought I would go into web design, but then I realized I wasn't going to, and I don't want to delete that information. That's research. It could be useful, but I just got the whole web design resource folder and just put the whole thing into archives.
That's beautiful. So now this is the best way to demonstrate this stuff. So one of the other things you say in the blog post specifically is on, this is part two, connect. We've already kind of gone into para, the you know, projects, area, resources, archive, which is a part of part two. But you've also, you use this phrase, design notes for your future self. I really like that because it sounds very obvious and simple, but if you think most people save what you just saved, and I have an equivalent of this, and what I do is I normally, like I do this a lot for podcasts because podcasts are long, right? And there's not text out of the box for podcasts, right? Unless you use you know, transcript. And sorry, when I say podcast, I mean other people's podcasts I listen to, not just mine. Mm-hmm. And I normally write like bullet points or like parts that I really liked. So sometimes I'll go back to them and I don't want to listen to the whole thing, but I'll go back to a timestamp and we'll say, oh, I remember this one passage they talked about this and it was a really interesting discussion or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I've loved doing it for stuff like that. I'm curious how you, is there an example you could share about designing notes for your future self, what that looks like?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of such a kind of deep idea, which is, you know, you have a relationship with your past self and your future self. It's almost like there's different people, different versions of yourself through time.
Yeah, right? I love that. Yeah.
So like, let's start with your past self. Think of like, try to just visualize your past self. Like, what do they look like? What are they wearing? Where do they live? What are they doing? What are they working on? Right.
I love dodgy facial hair. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a great visual just to think of that person. If they were writing, a 16-year-old Bilal was writing a note for future Bilal, what would that potentially look like?
Exactly. Yeah. So the same way you feel about your past self, your future self is going to look back on your present self. Right. And so when you take notes, it's kind of like making a time capsule. You're writing something in this little capsule that is going to travel through time into the future and hopefully provide value to your future self. Like we don't think about note-taking as time travel, but it kind of is. And so when you take notes, you really kind of want to imagine how your future self is going to make use of this. Right? When you say are reading a book and you're saving page after page, thousands of highlights, okay, that may feel good in the moment because you're like, oh, I'm saving everything. I'm not going to lose or forget anything. But just empathize for a minute with your future self. Okay. A month from now, a year from now, years from now, they're going to come upon this note full of thousands of highlights. Is that going to be attractive to them? Is that going to be welcoming for them? Are they going to want to spend all this extra effort to go through and make sense of all those highlights? Probably not.
That. Yeah, yeah. That's a great filter for what you're essentially curating in the first place. So like I'm just repeating what I'm hearing, which is the original thing of curating. Like, we've got so much information. There's a fire hose of information, unlimited information. What are the parts that if you were sharing that as a newsletter or to your friend, what you're going to text someone? Like, that is how I'm thinking of a curator in that case. And in this case, when you're looking in the future, like at the moment you were highlighting and the book was great and there was a cool passage, but really, is that something you actually want to save, or is it just something that was nice to read for that moment? And then, so going into that final kind of step, the create part, right? And this is from the blog post. I know in the, you've got, the four steps in the book. But essentially, like, express is the final part in the book too, right? Because I would say, like, the organize and distill is kind of like the middle part where you're connecting all these things together. And then the final part, which we all care about, which is, I've taken in all this information. I've read this beautiful book. I've listened to this podcast. Now I want to actually do something with it. So in practice, what does that look like for you? So maybe let's use the example of writing, because I think it's something quite tangible. And I know you've just finished writing a book. So maybe to make it simpler than a book, because a book is, you know, many chapters and hours worth of writing, months worth of writing, or years in some cases. Let's say we're going to write a Twitter thread. And what would that look like for you? So let's say I say, hey, I want to write a Twitter thread on finding your voice creatively. And I know, I'm just saying this for personally, because I know once upon a time I've asked questions on the podcast to a few people, and maybe there's a way for me to pull and distill some of those summarized points. Uh-huh. If I had been doing my job correctly, the way you just showed, I wouldn't be starting from scratch when I search Evernote, right? So what does that actual process look like for someone like yourself?
Yeah, you know, it's a bit messy. Express, it's funny. The reason we put in the work of capturing, organizing, and distilling is because expression is inherently kind of chaotic, right? I wish there was like a checklist I could give you. Here's how to write a banger of a blog post or an article or an essay. There just isn't. I feel like I pretty much do it in a different way each time.
Okay, that's interesting.
Don't believe people who want to sell you their winning formula, as if it's just, this checklist you follow. It's really not. What I do know is that chaotic, messy process is far easier. It's far more effective. It's far more successful when I'm not starting with a blank page. That's the thing I think you want to avoid at all costs. Like, there's nothing more terrifying and nothing that will sort of like suppress your creativity more than a blank canvas, a blank page, a blank piece of paper. Completely. So what you want to do is when you sit down, just have, if you have a rich collection of distilled building blocks of information that you have already decided are interesting or valuable or surprising, it's kind of just a matter of, it's like when you play Scrabble, like a Scrabble game, you know, when you're looking, you have your letters there, you're looking for a word. What do? You just keep rearranging the letters. And eventually something like a word kind of jumps out at you. That's exactly how it is with notes. You just have to juxtapose and put different notes kind of next to each other, one above the other, in combination, one on top of the other. And these associations and connections just start to organically emerge. And when one emerges, that is the spark that is like the hook of your essay, the lead, the beginning of your tweet, the beginning of your YouTube video.
Got it. Yeah, no, I love that. And so just in practical terms, because I remember this is from years ago, like the video I mentioned with you and David Perel, there was, I think maybe he was sharing a screen. I can't remember. I think you took turns sharing your screens, and he would, or one of you would search for one of these phrases and you'd say, oh, there was this article I read about this. And that would be like those building blocks, like you said, right? So that was kind of just one of the things I wanted to demonstrate is when I first read your work, the thing that stood out to me the most was just don't start from scratch every time. Like, make it easy on yourself. You're already doing all this hard work, essentially taking all this information, right? Like, we're already doing it out of curiosity for fun or whatever it might be, but you don't need to start literally from scratch each time. So, that makes a lot of sense, man. So I know we're going to run out of time in a few minutes. So thanks again for sharing some really great examples there. And I'd say to everyone, definitely go check out the book. And if you're interested in going deeper, I'd do it in this order. I would check out the blog post because it's you know, already online, it's free. There's no reason not to do that at all. Then if you're interested, definitely go buy the book. I'd say actually just buy the book anyway, because it's a really great, it's already kind of distilled and updated with all that deeper information. And if you really want to go further, you've obviously got the course, which people should check out as well. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else we didn't get to talk about? We've got a couple of minutes left that you'd love to leave the listeners on. Any messages for them?
I would just say check out buildingasecondbrain.com. You can find out everything you would ever want to know about the second brain, including a lot of free resources. But otherwise, yeah, the book is the single best, you know, repository of everything that I have to offer.
Love it, man. And yeah, lots of people that I know who are some of my favorite writers and stuff have used your system. So I really would recommend people go check it out. So thanks again, Tiago, for coming on the show. Really appreciate all the time. And hopefully we'll get to do this in person at some point as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Cheers, man. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. Helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.